Thank you. I'm deeply honored to have been invited to this event, both to be included among such distinguished company, and especially to participate in this celebration of Abner Shimoni's prodigious contributions to physics and philosophy. Going back to my student days, Abner has been a towering source of inspiration to me personally and professionally. While I was never a student of his in the formal sense, I've learned from Abner much more than he could possibly know, and much more than that for which I could possibly thank him adequately. I met Abner over 30 years ago, which is hard to believe. The occasion was a meeting of the Boston Colloquium for the Philosophy of Science. Abner had invited me to comment on a talk by Don Howard, a talk entitled Einstein on Locality and Separability. Don and I have remained friends ever since that time, and we've enjoyed a good many iterations of the discussion begun that evening in Boston. It was also Abner who introduced me to John Bell when he was in Boston to give a lecture. I got to talk with Bell at some length on a few subsequent occasions. Abner paved the way. I think it's fair to say that Abner, Don, and I, and of course a host of others, have long been fascinated by the species of non-separability exhibited by physical systems witnessing the violation of Bell-type inequalities. This has led me to my topic this morning. I'm going to say some things that I consider to fall under the general heading of the meaning of Bell's theorem. My goal is to say a few things that are correct and not already widely known or glaringly obvious. Failing that, I'd be satisfied with saying a few things that are at least mistaken in some interesting way. I say this, trust me, not to be modest. As I stand before the many luminaries in this particular audience, I can't fully suppress a fear that the goal of not wasting your time borders on the recklessly ambitious. So I'm going to assume now that you're sufficiently buttered up and that I've managed to lower somewhat the high expectations you might reasonably have had based on nothing more than the appearance of my name alongside the others, the true heavy hitters, on our list of speakers. With that, I'll now proceed to take that whack at saying a few things about Bell's theorem. Many of us have come to like discussing Bell's theorem in the context of an idealized version of this so-called Merman contraption. I guess at one time there must have been somebody named Merman who started doing this. But I imagine most of you are already quite familiar with the general background here. Some of my nomenclature and notation is probably idiosyncratic, so I put it on the handout, and it's on the slides, but I won't say too much about this. You've got these two devices, detectors of some sort, on either side of a source. Each detector can measure any one of three different things. The measurement outcomes consist of a red light or a green light coming on. Distinct measurements are brought about by setting the switch in one of the three positions. Excuse me. A candidate theory for experiments of this sort has to give us joint probability functions of the sort indicated. Here, lambda is the posited state of the two-particle system. X and Y, the outcomes at site A and B, respectively. I and J, the switch settings at site A and B, respectively. The predictions of the theory, then, are given by integrating these joint probability functions given the state lambda over the distribution of states, rho of lambda, which then the theory must also specify. In terms of the joint probability functions, we can also define marginal probabilities for A and B. I call locality the constraint that each of the marginals is independent of the switch setting at the distant site. Abner likes to call this parameter independence for good reason. Locality is taken to mean a lot of different things. Parameter independence is a descriptive, univocal expression. I've retained this terminology, perhaps unwisely, but mainly out of deference to Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. I think that this constraint, while not in any strict sense equivalent to the relativistic prohibition on superluminal signaling, does function in the Bell arguments in a manner that's very similar in spirit to the way that locality, in the sense of EPR, gets employed in their argument, and similarly for completeness. Abner has called this outcome independence. It expresses the independence of the probabilities at one site, the independence of those probabilities of the outcome at the other site. There's a sense in which this can be seen to be a kind of completeness condition. This kind of independence is just the sort of thing that you would expect if the information associated with the outcome over here is redundant, so that it doesn't alter the probability you might assign over here. The conditional probability of such and such over here, given the outcome here, is the same as the unconditioned probability, because the state description already includes that information. It's complete. There's nothing more that you can learn from what you might find here based on what you get over here. This is a condition that also in the literature gets called factorizability. Too many piles of stuff here. Okay, here we go. I want to introduce another constraint here that I'll come back to a bit later. For the moment, it's just a kind of curiosity. If we define this matrix of probabilities assigned to the four possible pairs of outcomes given specified lambda, I, and J, call that matrix C, and then require that for all values of lambda, I, and J, the determinant of that matrix vanish. Turns out that that's logically equivalent to completeness, and that can be easily checked just by substituting in the expressions for the probabilities in question. It also is useful to point to the equivalence between condition C and completeness in order to see that determinism or deterministic theories, those that assign probabilities in the range 0 and 1 only, are complete, but the converse doesn't hold in general. If a theory is deterministic, then 3 of the 4 probabilities in the matrix C have the value 0, the other has the value 1, and so clearly the determinant vanishes. But there are lots of numbers that are in the interval 0 to 1 that add up to 1, for which the determinant indicated there does vanish, even though it's not the case of 3 zeros and 1 1. Finally, strong locality is the requirement that both of these kinds of independence hold. Probability here is independent of both the switch setting over here and the outcome over here. And strong locality then is equivalent to the conjunction of locality and completeness, and it's strong locality that gives us the generalized Bell type inequalities. While there's not a universal consensus on this, most people, I think it's fair to say, do regard completeness to be the culprit in this scheme with the violation of Bell type inequalities. The tendency seems to be to want to retain locality and reject completeness. Quantum mechanics satisfies locality in this sense, violates completeness. Excuse me. So while I certainly want to acknowledge that I know there's a case to be made that we should be open-minded about this, I'm going to set those concerns aside for the purposes of my talk today. Well, I want to ask now what else might be said about theories that do violate completeness. I mean, if we are pursuing the line that the lesson or one of the lessons that we learned from Bell's theorem is that apart from the empirical adequacy of quantum mechanics, apart from its future successes or demise, any succeeding theory is going to have to violate completeness. Just what does it mean to be incomplete? Is there more that we can say? And this is where Don Howard comes in. Guided by considerations raised by Einstein in his, that is, Einstein's own incompleteness argument, this is not the EPR argument, but the one he gave in a 1948 paper in Dialectica, Howard characterizes separability as each of the putative subsystems possessing its own distinct physical state in such a way that they fix the state of the composite system. Don has published a number of papers in which he talks about this, and that's my paraphrase, but that's the gist of it, I think. And this, Don says, is precisely the content of the completeness constraint. So Don says completeness, in the sense I'm using it here, ought to be construed simply as separability. But there are two questions I think ought to be addressed before allowing that. First of all, are states themselves appropriately regarded as probability functions or in correspondence with probability functions? And second, even if states are so regarded, why ought separability, or something we want to interpret with that name, why ought separability require that the state of the composite system be determined by the states, respectively, of the two component subsystems in the particular manner specified by completeness? Why couldn't it be determined by those things in some other way and still then be considered satisfying separability? Well, quantum mechanical states, of course, are in one-to-one correspondence with probability measures over the set of closed linear subspaces of a Hilbert space. So quantum mechanics is one example of a theory that effectively identifies states with probability functions. Classical mechanics can be regarded as a theory of that type as well. But in classical mechanics, we can also represent states as points in a phase space, associating exact values of the position and momentum of each particle with the state of the system. So suppose we were to try to generalize this, consider theories for which the states are given by specification of values of some distinguished set of physical magnitudes. Let's call them, I don't know, elements of physical reality, or EPRs. The EPRs need not be restricted to properties like the values of position and momentum, nor need the EPRs be restricted to properties in the ordinary sense at all. They might include, for example, irreducibly dispositional quantities, represented probabilistically as physical propensities. How then might we think about characterizing something that we want to call separability? Well, here's an approach, roughly we want three requirements. We want to require the existence of functions f sub a and f sub b such that f sub a acting on lambda gives you a state lambda sub a to be associated with the a subsystem. F sub b acting on lambda gives you a state lambda sub b associated with the b subsystem, so that you get a decomposition of lambda into subsystem states by this means. Now I'm weaving unspecified here the details of what would have to be fed into this expression, a decomposition of lambda into subsystem states. Presumably there would be a lot involved to spell that out. There are some things I can say about that, but I don't really want to digress to do that, because it's going to turn out that for my purposes this morning, all of the details of that are irrelevant. What's really going to matter here are clauses 2 and 3. Clause 2, just the requirement that the probability functions determined by the subsystem states, lambda sub a, lambda sub b, respectively, are equal to the corresponding marginal probability functions. We want that in order for consistency in the definition of the joints. And then here's my way of imposing on this picture what I consider to be a reasonable separability constraint. I mean, the real meat of the separability constraint. Let H bar here be the Shannon information function. So we want to say here that the information, in the sense of Shannon information, associated with the probability function given by the composite system state description is equal to the sum of the two corresponding pieces associated with the subsystem states. One way of many ways one could try to make precise the cliche that the whole is equal to the sum of the parts. I distinguish this EPR separability from separability simplicator, where the latter is just the requirement that the information associated with those probability functions, composite system probability function information equals the sum of the information associated with the two marginals. So if you have, if your interested in trying to make sense of this EPR conception of state that I've been waving my hands about, then separability for you might mean something like EPR separability. But if you don't want to buy into that and just go with probability functions as being in correspondence with states, not reducible to any deeper lying elements of physical reality, then separability is probably what you want, or something like that. Excuse me. Well, of course, from clause 3, EPR separability entails plain separability. From clause 1, the converse does not hold. The point being that you can have separability in the unqualified sense satisfied without that saying anything whatsoever about the relationship or not saying anything at all about a decomposition of lambda into a lambda sub A and a lambda sub B. So you can certainly have theories in this region. And if you prefer to talk about this from the other direction, define a holism, if one likes, as the denial of separability, EPR holism as the denial and the negation of EPR separability, then the picture looks like that. If we assume for the moment that we must reject separability as I've characterized it here, in this information theoretic sense, then I think it's important to recognize that buying into holism is, well, actually, let me hold off on that. I should get on the table another point here first. Since it's completeness that we're rejecting, we need to ask what relationship there is between completeness and separability in this sense of the term. And that's what I want to comment on now. Turns out that separability in that sense and completeness are logically equivalent. Can construct a chain of equivalences as indicated here. Again, I'll remind you, C is that matrix. I think it's on page 2 of your supplement. So in rejecting completeness, we're giving up not just EPR separability. We're giving up that gap between EPR separability and separability. Separability is logically equivalent to completeness. We have to get outside that circle in the diagram. Quantum mechanics is out there. So that depending on what your views about the proper way to characterize states might be, one might say that the implications of Bell's theorem and the experimental tests are even more radical than some have, or some might have thought. We have maybe a still more radical retreat from the classical worldview than perhaps is commonly appreciated. Just very quickly mention something. Eric Winsberg and Arthur Fine, in a response to Don Howard, have proposed that we take as separability or a suitable separability constraint simply that the joint probability function itself be some function of the marginals. That it be the product of the marginals would be a special case of that, but that to require that is overly restrictive in their view. And the thing I just want to point out now is that if one does accept the characterization of states as probability functions not reducible to elements of physical reality, and if one goes along with the characterization of the information theoretic, Shannon information theoretic conception of separability I've indicated here, then that F is the product function is forced upon us. And as one further sort of tangential point, we can define mutual information as indicated here. I don't want to belabor this, but as mutual information is a symmetric function is apparent from the definition. If completeness is satisfied, well, if and only if completeness is satisfied, then these conditional probabilities, each reduced to the unconditioned probabilities, and so completeness is satisfied just in case the mutual information here is zero. And what that means is that the information, and this is just from the definition interpretation of mutual information, the information in the composite system state description is such that conditionalization on the outcome at one measurement site has no bearing on the probabilities assigned at the other site, the former providing merely redundant information with respect to such a complete state description. And I'm commenting on this just to try to add a little bit of reinforcement to the earlier interpretation I suggested for completeness. Well, I want to look now at the possibility of generalizing some of this stuff. So now instead of having just two subsystems A and B, associated outcome variables X and Y. Now we've got S subsystems, and at each site, there are N possible outcomes to whatever measurements can be performed there. Leave that open, how many measurements or how many measurement types there are. But we can define things in essentially the, or in the natural way here, a joint probability function, marginals by summing over all but the one, outcomes for all but the one variable. And completeness then looks like this. It's, again, just the requirement that the joint probabilities be the product of all the marginals. Separability is a requirement that the information associated with the composite system state description, that is the joint probability function, be the sum of the information in each of the marginals. Condition C becomes kind of odd here. We can define this matrix of value assignments to the probability, to the joint probability function, only now it's got S dimensions, where S is the number of subsystems, and along each dimension there are N elements, because there are N possible outcomes to each measurement, and there is a determinant that can be defined for objects of that sort. And so the first thing to look at as a candidate here for a generalization is that the hyperdeterminant of this matrix C vanish. And let me mention one further sort of auxiliary condition, I'm calling it condition Q. I'm not going to try to interpret this for you. That's what I'm calling it. You'll see why I'm using it, or why I bother with that in just a moment. I think you've got this on the handout. The thing of it is, if we define such an object, then the generalized form of that equation or that constraint asterisk that was back on page 4 of your supplement, the generalization of that takes this form, and one can see in this form that it does have the original equation asterisk as a special case. In that case, the case where S and N are both 2, all of the components of that Q matrix up to a sign are just the determinant of C. And so when that vanishes, the Q's are zeros, and that's trivially satisfied. And it goes the other direction, too. We have this chain of equivalences. Now, this chain actually corresponds to the path I took before a colleague of mine drew my attention to the Shannon Gibbs inequality, which I probably should have known all along, but didn't. The equivalence of separability and completeness follows from the Shannon Gibbs inequality, and I found a few different proofs of Shannon Gibbs, but none of them proceeds via the route I took. They're all a lot more straightforward, simpler. I always do things the hard way. Yet it occurs to me that there might yet be some further interest here, and I want to use the rest of my time here to share with you my thinking on this. Suppose I had said, let's define completeness that way, and then suppose I proved for you that, as so defined, completeness is logically equivalent to that constraint. And let's suppose further that I'd given this a name, say condition S. Well, at first glance, your reaction might be, well, okay, fine. You've managed to write completeness in a more complicated way. Great. But as soon as you looked at that condition S and thought about it for a second, you'd say, well, wait a minute, that looks like entropy, or that's information. That's the requirement that the information in the probability function representing the composite system is equal to the sum. Yeah, that's holes. Yeah, that's a separability constraint. Ah, and so then you get a connection. Then you get a link between two conceptually distinct classes of theories. You've got the theories that satisfy completeness in the sense defined. You've got the theories that satisfy separability in the sense defined. And now we see that those two sets are coextensive. Well, I'm wondering if something like that might be done for condition C as well. And there's no reason that would have to be so. It might just be another way of writing completeness, or now separability as well. But it might carry with it no sort of independent physical interpretation that would help us deepen our understanding of completeness or separability. But the thing that's very suggestive, of course, about condition C posed as the vanishing of a determinant is that is the necessary and sufficient condition for the existence of non-trivial solution to a particular set of equations. And could write down these solutions and put them in lots of different forms and think about them. And, one way of looking at them, and I'm not going to take the time to go into this now, but there's these expressions in a way look like some kind of expectation value vanishing. But the thing whose expectation value it is doesn't look to have any special significance. Another way, of course, of saying what the vanishing of that determinant means is that this matrix equation here has a zero eigenvalue solution. Okay, well, what does that matrix equation mean? What's the physical interpretation of that? What would it mean to demand of a theory that the corresponding matrix equation of that sort have any solution let alone a zero eigenvalue solution. I don't know. I don't know. But I'd like to think there is something there. Here's my conjecture. We've got equivalence of separability, condition Q, condition C, and completeness in the simplest case. And I've made some progress on generalizing for higher values of N and S, at least between certain pairs of these conditions. My conjecture is that it does hold for arbitrary values of N and S greater than or equal to 2. And just to summarize sort of where I think things are, at least where I know they are, as far as my investigation of this is, 1's trivial, 2 isn't, but is established a straightforward generalization of the Shannon-Gibbs result. 3, I have the question mark there because I can't produce a proof, but I have a lot of confidence really about this. It's kind of extending either the method I used, the roundabout way of doing it, or finding another technique by a much more complicated array of series expansions than you'll ever want to meet. 4, as I say, I think is pretty much 4 I can do. It takes just a little bit of bookkeeping. 5 is one that I have the question mark there because I haven't done this. I can't find that much about hyperdeterminants, and it's I'm not really sure where that's going. The S equals 3 case, N equals 2 that I've been looking at, looks like that's coming together. So I'm probably using too much wishful thinking here, but it's funny. I was sharing this with Andre Mirabelli last night when I was trying to work out some of this, and I was talking with a young student who's been helping me with some of this, doing the computer work. He did the handouts for me. His name is Thomas Ferguson. Thanks, Thomas. I was trying to calculate the determinants of these matrices, and he calls me up in the middle of the night and says, John, Google on Dodgson condensation. Now maybe some of you, maybe most of you know all about this. I don't think I ever heard of this even when I was taking linear algebra, but there's this algorithm called Dodgson condensation that tells you how to express the determinant of an n by n matrix in terms of the determinant of an n minus 1 by n minus 1 determinant, where the entries in the latter matrix are themselves fixed by determinants of submatrices of the original big matrix. And you keep doing this till you get down to a 2 by 2. And I had told Thomas the night before that this is all so overwhelming. I feel like Alice in Wonderland, and I just, it's that Dodgson, Charles Ludwig. Well, let's see. I do want to wrap up here pretty quickly, just summarizing some things here. The I mean, again, this is my conjecture for arbitrary N and S without the intermediary of condition Q. I put the check mark there on the left, perhaps a little prematurely, and the one on the right is more a hope, I guess, than a confident belief at this point. And I'm trying to come up with some way of thinking about this constraint, this condition C. I mean, a way that isn't just obviously one more way of expressing completeness or condition, some ways such that the recognition that it is equivalent to those conditions will give us some small deepening of our understanding of completeness, and then will help us understand better what it is we're giving up when we reject completeness as it seems we must. I want to then close by offering Abner a public thank you for all the help and encouragement you've given me over the years, the kindness you've shown me, and for the gift you've given all of us, your remarkable body of work. Thank you. Let's see, the assumption would be that we consider candidate theories that posit a set of states, hidden states if you like, but whatever, and that in terms of those states, they must generate empirically testable predictions by means of these p sub lambda functions and a distribution function, rho of lambda. But I think any theory that does that much, then if it satisfies strong locality, makes predictions that are constrained by Clausewitz-Horn Shimoni Hull, and so it's in the soup. Which assumption? I don't know. I don't know how one. Yeah, I'd have to think about that, Lucien. I'm not sure. I have to remember my mic is on before I say an expletive.
What do you mean by a hyperdeterminism? Is that just a determinant of
Well, Yeah, I can show you algebraically for the three-dimensional case. A three-dimensional cube. But it doesn't have an easy geometric interpretation. I don't think I have. Well, maybe I do have it with me. I'll see what I got in my thing. But are you staying here for the whole?
Yeah.
I'll try it down.
You know, when I saw your first conditions, I looked at.